When it comes to guns, it seems like there are three kinds of people in America. There are the people who love guns, there are the people who hate them, and there are the people who don't really care much about them.
So I did not grow up around firearms. It was just never something that was on my radar. I was a competitive ballroom dancer, and my mom's a, you know, physics teacher and a professional figure skater, and my dad's hobby was golf. I'm Ashley Levinsky, curator of the Cody Firearms Museum at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West.
And I'm Ann Strandchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and today's show begins with a conversion story. Story of how a 25-year-old former ballroom dancer fell in love with guns.
I got an internship at a museum in Pittsburgh, where I'm from, and I was walking through the gallery one day. There was a Civil War era Enfield rifle on the wall, and the soldier who had it during the war had carved every battle that he fought in into the stock, hand-carved while he was sitting there. I don't remember how many battles, but I remember the stock was completely covered. You know, it was one of those wow moments for me because I realized that there's a story about people here that really I had never thought about, and, you know, that this was that soldier's lifeline. And think about, you know, going out to the battlefield and sitting there and, you know, potentially being bored, you know, in between battles and just sitting there and carving. So after that internship, I actually learned how to shoot, and I learned how to shoot historic and modern guns, and I just, you know, got enthralled with the stories and the diverse stories of people and all of the different people that have encountered firearms throughout history.
Today, Ashley Levinsky is the curator in charge of 7,000 historic guns at the Cody Firearms Museum in Cody, Wyoming. And she's here because we're talking about guns today. But we're not talking about gun control or regulation or gun violence. You've heard all that before. Instead, we're wondering what happens, what changes, if you just think about the gun as an object. Maybe see it through a curator's eyes. Ashley, could you pick one historic gun from your collection, one of your favorites maybe, and tell us about it?
Sure. One of the guns, the first one I actually ever worked on, is a Colt Model 1861 Navy. And I found this gun interesting because it's a Colt. Samuel Colt, he patented the first revolving mechanism in the United States in 1836. And, you know, most people know that as the handgun that won the West, a marketing slogan. But, you know, it was one of the most iconic guns, and it's serial number one.
One. You've got the first one?
Yes, I have the first one. This was the birth of that particular firearm, you know, serial number one. What's so fascinating about this firearm is we know who it belonged to. And it was a private out of a New York Yonkers regiment named Charles Slate. He went by Caleb. He enlisted, I want to say it was May 21st or May 22nd, 1861. He lucked into serial number one when he walked into the store and bought it. And it's just kind of all of those things coming together and making you realize that an object has an ability to tell a story.
You know, I'm thinking there could hardly be a more polarizing object in this country than a gun. You and I could look at the same gun, and depending on our personal and family history and politics, where we stand on gun control or the Second Amendment, we could have completely different and very visceral reactions to the very same object.
Correct. You know, in today's society, it is impossible right now to divorce, you know, all of the emotional sentiments that comes around the object. Where there is the Bloomberg group, there is the NRA. Where there is one side, there's someone on the other side, and somewhere in the middle is the object. And so the best thing that I can do at a museum is acknowledge that those sentiments exist so that you can hopefully find your way from the ends into the middle, which is where the actual object sits.
For example, pick what was one of the historic, the gun that won the West, supposedly, the Winchester. So you must have an amazing or a famous Winchester in your collection.
We have a few.
Why do I think that's an understatement?
We are the Winchester. We were given the Winchester Arms Collection in 1975. So we have thousands of Winchesters. And we do have several historic ones. Actually, I can talk about a more contemporary one, which is a Winchester Model 70 that was made for President Kennedy.
Okay. Tell me about that one.
So we have a series of presidential presentation rifles, and that's pretty common, really going all the way back in history that, you know, firearms and, you know, other types of weaponry have been given to, you know, nobility of a country, you know, royalty. I do have Catherine the Great, Empress of Russia's blunderbuss that she gave to King Louis the 15th.
Wow.
Yeah. So this was a bolt action. It's called the Model 70, the rifleman's rifle is how it's been marketed. That was made and engraved for President Kennedy. Kennedy was one of eight presidents to be an NRA life member. He was an avid sportsman, and it was in the custom shop when he was assassinated, and so it was never given to him. It's actually never been fired. But, you know, I like the story of President Kennedy only in the sense of I don't think people expect that, and that he, you know, was such a sportsman for most of his life.
Well, he was also killed by a gun.
Correct. He was killed by a gun, and that is one of the things that we deal with in the museum, which is how do you tell difficult stories. We're still, you know, kind of working out and feeling out how to communicate it best so that people understand that it's one part of the story, but it's not the whole story.
Yeah. It's just, it gets so complicated. I mean, we're talking shortly after George Zimmerman put up for auction the gun that killed Trayvon Martin, a historic gun, I guess, but in a terrible way. Would that gun be something you could see a museum displaying someday? I mean, are there guns that are just, they have such a terrible history, they shouldn't be displayed? Or is terrible history still worth looking at?
It's all about historical distance with a lot of these things and historical memory. Mm-hmm. I believe that you can have firearms that are, you know, you have been used by the bad guys in history. It's a part of the story. And the issue comes in with, you know, how you do that in such an emotion with an object that's so emotional. How do you kind of break down that, you know, emotional wall so that you can have a bigger story of why that happened, what that meant. But a lot of the times with these more recent historical, these more recent things that happen, I don't envision them happening in a museum for a long time because of the historical distance mm-hmm. and the respect of what happened. But it is, you know, we've had conversations about this with, you know, how historically, you know, things that have happened, you know, become, you know, glorified through movies, Billy the Kid and John Dillinger and those are kind of iconic figures, but you don't look at them the same way as you would look at someone today. And it all comes down to that historical distance.
What's the most controversial gun you've ever seen or handled?
Let me think about that. When I was with the Smithsonian, they have, for example, the Kent State firearms. The FBI stickers on them. And those are not exhibited. Those are back in the vault. That would probably be the most one that I've encountered.
Well, I guess I'm asking you about guns that maybe have a dark history, because I'm curious about the ways in which we come to see an object as inherently bad.
The concept of blaming an object for, you know, human actions actually goes all the way back to Plato and Socrates. And then it was actually a part of English Parliament up through the 1800s, where you could essentially, I'm going to try not to butcher this, but if a, you know, cart fell on someone, you could have that cart destroyed. You know, fell on someone, killed that person, you know, you could have that cart destroyed. And it was called a deodand. You know, it's interesting to point out that we've been anthropomorphizing objects for a really long time, and that this is just the contemporary, you know, one that we're fixating on. My mission at the Cody Firearms Museum is not to make everyone come out of the museum loving firearms. It's to make people come out with a greater understanding of what they are, how they function, the people who have been involved in it, and that involves the good and the bad.
Ashley Lubinsky is the curator of the Cody Firearms Museum at the Buffalo Bills Center of the West in Cody, Wyoming. So if I say guns in the West, what do you see? And with music like this in the background, I bet you see a sheriff and an outlaw facing off on a dusty main street. Or maybe a cowboy riding off into the sunset with his horse and his trusty rifle. Guns are part of the American myth. They're part of our national DNA, right? Well, not quite, says Pamela Haag. Her new book, The Gunning of America, argues that gun culture was created, advertised, and sold to Americans. by the gun manufacturers, companies with iconic names like Colt and Remington. She told Charles Monroe Kane to look no further than the manufacturer of the Winchester repeater rifle, Oliver Winchester.
He made his fortune first as a men's shirt manufacturer and made his first investment in the gun industry in 1855. Now, to our knowledge, he had not owned a gun or displayed a gun in his house before that time, so he didn't have particularly passionate feelings about guns. He once described the gun unromantically but accurately as a machine made to throw balls.
A machine made to throw balls. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. It's true, I guess.
Yeah, it's accurate. He was very empirical. He was very empirically minded. So he is misremembered today as the inventor of the Winchester repeater rifle that bears his name, but he wasn't. His inventive contribution to America was an 1848 patent for an improved men's shirt collar that, in his words, remedied the evil of the too-tight neckband.
Wow. Wow. We don't have a Second Amendment on that one, do we? It's funny when you think about what you're saying, because the gun is just an object. I mean, it is just a thing. Yeah, sure, it has the capacity to kill people, but it is just an object. And it seems like, from reading your book, that there's all this time in history from frontier life where it was functional. And then it had this thing that's had feelings. And it seems those feelings were manufactured by the gun manufacturers.
For much of American history, the gun was a tool. It had practical utility, it had value as a tool, just as a plow or barbed wire had value. And interestingly, it's sort of the narrative of the gun industry that brings that more functional relationship to guns to the forefront. I would say that was a dominant attitude toward guns for much of the 1800s for many Americans. But that does change. And to me, a key moment when the gun becomes more than simply a tool, more than simply an object, is really the turn of the century. Really, it's more at the time when America is post-frontier, when we're a modern society, an urban society in the 1900s. But at this time, in part because of the gun industry, the mystique of the gun really does begin to deepen.
Why? Is that just nostalgia?
Well, if you adopt the point of view of the gun maker and the gun manufacturer, it makes a lot of sense. At the moment when fewer and fewer Americans actually needed guns, how was the gun going to maintain its value as a product? How was it going to maintain its lure as something to buy? It's at this time, really, that partly as a function of the gun's obsolescence, the gun industry begins to imbue the gun with more intangible values, more symbolic values.
What was that like? So, were there ads? What were they like? They must have been pretty incredible back then.
For example, Winchester and Remington started dispatching people who they called missionaries to start stoking up zeal and enthusiasm for the gun. In the 1890s and 1880s, they started printing these chromolithographic calendars that began to sell the gun in terms of emotions. The calendars would depict these predicament scenes between man and foe or beast that remained unresolved. So adrenaline was really what was selling the guns. And the biggest change, or at least the most obvious change, really is in the advertisement.
Yeah, right.
In the 1800s, you could see ads for guns that were literally instructions, like turn knob A,
right,
move lever C. By the early 20th century, you're reading very different kinds of ads, very much about every real boy wants a gun. Mm-hmm. It's a natural instinct to want a gun. They were kind of drawing on the vocabulary of psychology, this new field of psychology. You know your son wants a gun, but you don't know how much. It's beyond words. So there's this much more emotionally charged way of thinking about the gun. And the industry itself also started drawing on history and using history selectively to develop that sense of nostalgia. And, oh, well, the gun has really been, you know, responsible for every major change in American history, and, you know, use that as a selling point as well.
You know, I'm curious, and I'm not trying to put moral considerations on historic figures, but I'm thinking of people like Colt, and I'm thinking of like Winchester and Smith and Wesson, these names we know, right? They're doing this on purpose.
Yes.
They're building a product that doesn't have a lot of obsolescence built into it. Their sales are down, so they're trying to drum up sales. They create some myth. They put it out there. Guns kill people, right? And certainly during wars, they kill people for sure. Do they ever write about, even though they're selling it, some in diaries or something where they're like, wow, I feel bad about this?
Well, that's a great question. They had somewhat different views, but somewhat the same view. This was a generation of self-made men who were very empirical. They tended to their contracts and to the short-term view of their business. Samuel Colt was by far the most ruthless and ambitious and laissez-faire in his view of guns. He sold to the South up until the last possible minute during the Civil War, saying that they should make hay while the sun shines. Oliver's constant refrain was really about the success of his business. He was in love with the idea of manufacturing something, whether it be a shirt or a gun, and then finding ways to make that business successful and to keep it a family business intergenerationally. So a lot of the moral energy in these men was more around being a successful entrepreneur and captain of industry. But in terms of feeling distant remorse or compunction or disquiet about what they're doing had done in the world, I didn't see evidence of that.
One of the things that really I did not know at all, and I was reading in your book, these guys, all there was wars and civil wars and revolutions happening all over the world, from Burma to South America. They were selling guns, huge amounts of guns all over the world.
Yes. All four of the major gun kings, the names we associate today with our gun culture, Colt, Winchester, Remington, Smith & Wesson, all of them survived in these years when American demand was abysmal by selling internationally. So Remington had a huge contract, for example, for 145,000 guns to France in 1870. Samuel Colt trailblazed the path and sold to the Tsar of Russia. So when we think about the consumer of the American-made gun, chances are we don't think of Tsar Nicholas II.
No, I don't.
Or the King of Siam, or the Juarez Revolutionary Forces. But these were the customers, and these were the contracts that sustained the American gun industry in years when otherwise it might have foundered. So really, this phenomenon, you know, we think America has this unique pathology with guns, but looked at from a business perspective, this was very much an international phenomenon of arming the world, even before we think about the frontier. Oliver Winchester stayed alive with a huge contract in 1870 for 20,000 of his rifles to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire.
You know, it's funny. I was reading your book and I was thinking about the Western, you know, the gunslinger in the West. Did that just happen culturally on accident because of Hollywood, or was the gun industry part of that, and did that happen on purpose?
So it's important to recognize when thinking about those gunslinger stories that in reality the West was less heavily armed with these glamorized weapons and handguns. It was less gun violent than we tend to imagine retrospectively based on a steady diet of Western films and dime novels and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And there were somewhat more gun regulations just at a local level, you know, even on the frontier and in the West than we tend to think. So the myths are incredibly powerful, but a lot of those gunslinger myths really exploded in the mid-20th century. I mean, a lot of the vision we have of this really gun-violent frontier and the gunslinger, a lot of that comes about from this staggering production, cultural production of stories about the gun in the West that happens in the 1950s.
Right. So look, we keep going, right? And as we keep going in history, population increases. There's less need for guns from that population, and they need to keep up production. And so there's a tension there. What ways? How do they continue? How's the gun industry continued into even the 21st century, and through the 20th century? How do they continue selling guns?
Today, when we talk about guns, we're not really talking about guns. We're talking about so many other things. You know, a political identification. And I think today that political identification is part of what sells the guns. Ironically, every time there is new gun control legislation at the state level, sales tend to bump up.
Right.
And otherwise, actually, it's been a struggle for the gun industry. In the 1950s, you know, perhaps half of households owned guns. Today, that's more like 34%. But what the gun industry is experiencing today is that fewer customers are buying more guns.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, the politics around guns, ironically, help to sell guns.
We're talking about the symbol. The physical gun itself is so powerful. I don't know how you can extract the myth, true or untrue, from it. You've done all this research. You've written a 600-page book on it. You come to today. Is there any way to extract this mythology and get it back to being this functional item, or is it part of the feeling of what it is? Is it more of an emotional thing, a totem, than it is now just a functional thing?
It's definitely going to maintain a certain kind of compelling value that might be very intangible but real for some Americans. For other Americans, it doesn't have that value at all. But those meanings can also be accompanied with some understanding of the gun's commercial life, of the fact that it was also something produced by an industry and sold and self-consciously promoted, you know, as an object that could sort of be seen as a sign of masculinity or of a hardy, rugged, individualist life. So I think that what we can do is maybe try to round out our picture about the gun's life in this country so that we're not just endlessly believing that guns have always stood for this. That's simply not the case.
Pamela Hogg's book is called The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Charles Monroe Kane talked with her, and actually Pamela also told him one other story that we thought was so good it kind of stands on its own. It's the legend of Sarah Winchester.
Sarah Winchester was actually the inspiration for my whole book. She was the daughter-in-law of Oliver Winchester, the Rifle King. She suffered a lot of misfortunes, and the legend holds that she was a spiritualist who came to believe that she was being haunted by the spirits, the ghosts of everyone killed by Winchester rifles, which unfortunately, even by the 1880s, was a fairly large number. Out of this guilt, the legend holds, she moved to San Jose, California after her husband Will died in 1881, and she bought some land and she started building. She built a house that would become the largest private residence in the country, the most expensive to build. It had 200 rooms, and it made absolutely no sense. She had builders working on it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. She would build staircases that went to the ceiling. She would build passages that went nowhere. She would build over rooms that she had earlier built and then just forget about them. She did this nonstop until her death in 1922. And the legend holds that she was either being instructed by the spirits to build in this way, or she was building as some kind of strange absolution for this blood fortune that she had inherited. So that is the ghost story, and I never was able to determine if she indeed thought herself to be haunted. I do think she's more like an artist, and she had a message to convey to us. And that message is that she is a counter-legend to the gun legends in America. She is the legend that stands against the gunslinger story. She is the legend about gun conscience.
Pamela Hogg with The Legend of Sarah Winchester. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from Organic Valley, a co-op of family farms committed to the craft of sustainable organic farming. Organic Valley believes in producing food in a way that respects the earth, animals, and future generations. More at organicvalley.com.
And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
I'm Ginger Strand, the author of The Brothers Vonnegut, and my dangerous idea is, liberals, go get yourself some guns. If you consider yourself an environmentalist, you should probably be hunting. Human beings have altered the ecosystems where they congregate dramatically by decreasing or eliminating other top predators. The only way to keep things in balance is step into that role ourselves. Here in the East, where I live, white-tailed deer are overabundant. They're scouring the forests and creating a hazard on highways. They're a vector for tick-borne disease. With the decline of hunting, it often seems their only natural predator is the SUV. Yet hunting is an ecological act. It puts people in touch with the natural resource, creating a powerful awareness that we're part of the ecosystem, not separate from it. And it provides a source of meat that's greener than factory farm cows or pigs. Hunting can even be used to manage invasive species, like the rampant wild pig known as Hogzilla that's laying waste to parts of the South. But I think there's an even stronger argument for broadening gun ownership. Currently, the nation seems to be divided into two groups, those who advocate gun control and those who own guns. I know that that's not actually the case, but it often seems that way. And that's pretty much the same as a bunch of folks who aren't in possession of uteruses coming up with ever more creative restrictions on reproductive health care. Okay, never mind that that's actually the case. A majority of Americans believe in sensible gun control. They believe in things like banning high-capacity magazines and instituting background checks. They believe in keeping guns out of the hands of the mentally ill or folks who happen to be on the terrorism watch list. They believe that assault weapons are neither relevant to sport hunting nor necessary for home defense. But all of these claims sound less convincing when they come from the mouths of people who've never owned a gun, never would own a gun, and might not even let their kids play with toy guns. It's just too easy to suspect that what someone like that wants is to get rid of all guns altogether. That accounts for at least part of the paranoid tone of so many in the gun rights community. I grew up on a farm, and we always had guns. My father used an over-and-under shotgun to dispatch rabbits who'd been injured by dogs and dogs who had eaten chickens. He kept it against the country contingencies, things like injured horses and rabid raccoons. He once used it to frighten a traveling salesman he didn't like. He's also an avid supporter of sensible gun control. He frequently writes letters to his congressperson about it. Coming from him, a gun owner in Michigan, those letters may have some credibility. So I propose that Greens and feminists and progressives of all types flock to the gun shops and stock up. Let's join our local gun clubs and blast away at targets and clay pigeons. Let's show up for the potluck turkey shoot with a casserole full of vegan lasagna. And let's write thousands of letters to our state and federal representatives demanding better gun control. Let's start each letter with the words, "As a gun owner, I believe." Who knows? Perhaps the prospect of tree huggers armed to the teeth or feminists packing heat will be the thing that finally changes the national conversation about making sure the right to bear arms doesn't infringe on the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That's Ginger Strand with A Dangerous Idea. She's also the author of a book called The Brothers Vonnegut. So sometime pretty soon, there'll be a new face on the $20 bill, Harriet Tubman. And with the image of her, most of us know, she's an old woman. She looks a bit stern. Her hair is covered, you know, by a dark cloth. But there's another less well-known portrait of Harriet Tubman in which she's holding a musket. Now, just think about that for a second. Why would Harriet Tubman pose with a gun? I mean, weren't the abolitionists and, you know, later the civil rights leaders, weren't they supposed to be peaceful? Well, law professor Nicholas Johnson is the author of Negroes and the Gun, and he told Steve Paulson that the history of Black American gun ownership has been almost erased.
Tubman with a musket is sort of a controversial image. And as you go through the history, you see some people who are uncomfortable with it. One biographer of Tubman's argued that her guns were always unloaded, that they were symbolic only. I'm not sure how one would know that. But yeah, I think people are uncomfortable with the idea.
Why do you think they're uncomfortable with the idea of her carrying a gun?
Because there's a disconnect between that sort of historical utility of firearms and the sort of modern issues that we grapple with on a daily basis, especially in the black community.
But when you think about her job, I mean, she was an abolitionist working on the Underground Railroad, I mean, you know, trying to protect escaped slaves. Carrying a gun made a lot of sense in that environment, didn't it?
One of the reasons that I wrote the book is that we have, in the modern era, gotten to a point where our discomfort with gun issues in the modern context has caused us to sort of lose sight of those important lessons and or at least the heroes. And people can draw their own views about what the lessons from that time are. But this is certainly a history that I think is worth remembering.
Well, let's talk about the history a bit because, I mean, frankly, if I'm trying to think of kind of famous historical episodes involving black people with guns, it's actually hard to think of that many. I mean, you know, in recent times, you know, think of the Black Panthers, you know, going back further, John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. You know, those are the kinds of things that would end up in textbooks. But I can't think of that many episodes where, you know, you have historical examples, the kinds of things that are written about in textbooks where black people are using guns to resist racism.
As you get into the details, what you find is almost exactly the opposite of what you've described. That is, all of the sort of famous notable figures had some sort of connection to either an endorsement, affirmative endorsement of armed self-defense, or carried guns or used guns in self-defense in the freedom struggle. And in fact, it's hard to find someone ultimately who wasn't in that category. For example, I use Martin Luther King in the book and the sort of the famous quote that was part of his conversation with Robert Williams. And people are shocked when they find that King endorsed self-defense particularly. And one of the things that King said, and I'll just paraphrase it, was that there's a distinction between self-defense and political violence, that self-defense is legitimate and that, on the other hand, political violence was folly, was a hazard. And that distinction is one that runs through the freedom movement. You see people, you see Frederick Douglass in the 1850s engaging this sort of distinction. You see similar icons of the movement in the latter part of the 19th century. Ida B. Wells, for example, pressing the same distinction. W.E.B. Du Bois at the turn of the century and all through the modern civil rights movement, you see this theme. So what King basically crystallized in his debate and his conversation with Robert Williams was a theme that was longstanding and it is vastly underreported, which was, again, one of the reasons that I wrote the book.
Well, and to cite a couple of the people you just mentioned, I mean, to actually quote them, Frederick Douglass said at one point when he was asked, you know, what do former slaves need to resist the manhunters trying to capture them? He said, a good revolver, a steady hand, and a determination to shoot. And then a little later, the anti-lynching activist Ida B. Wells said, the Winchester rifle should have a place of honor in every black home. The more the Afro-American yields and cringes and begs, the more he is insulted, outraged, and lynched.
Absolutely. And Wells was talking about the practical utility of firearms, and she was specifically referring to two recent averted lynchings where the armed black community, one in Paducah, Kentucky, another in Jacksonville, Florida, where armed blacks had come to the aid of potential lynch victims and saved those people. And this was not, you know, a daily story, but it was common enough that people like Wells and T. Thomas Fortune, who was, you know, the famous editor of the New York Age, all were sort of strong advocates of blacks arming themselves for self-defense against lynch violence and other sorts of terrorism.
So why do we not usually hear this story about how, you know, black people often did carry guns for self-defense?
Well, you know, the glib sense of the civil rights movement is that it was one of nonviolence. So if you ask people what they know about that history about the movement, it was sort of a nonviolent struggle. And in our popular conversation have cast blacks as victims, as sort of stoic sufferers in the face of the horrible things that were happening around them. And also, if you think about the history, lots of people will say, well, we had a civil war and then we had Reconstruction, to the degree people know anything about that. And then black people just sat on the sidelines until the 1960s and we really didn't have to pay attention to them. But it's that period, really, between Reconstruction and the 1960s that my book focuses on in detail and shows that there was this rich, not only political struggle, but also a struggle for survival where guns were vital, practical resources for people who were dealing with terrorism, were dealing with private threats. And that story, I guess, just does not fit the glib narrative that people were walking around with on a daily basis.
Well, and we've mentioned certain people who said some pretty interesting things about guns. And to quote another person, the civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer, when she was asked how she survived the threats from midnight white terrorists, she responded, "I keep a shotgun in every corner of my bedroom, and the first cracker even looked like he wants to throw some dynamite on my porch won't write his mama again." That's strong stuff.
On issues of private self-defense, she was quite willing to use a firearm for self-defense. And she carried on this tradition so there's another part of the story where you see disclosed that Fannie Lou Hamer introduced Stokely Carmichael to what might have been the first pistol that he carried as he was working in the South.
I mean, that's a sort of a fascinating moment in history you're describing. I mean, Fannie Lou Hamer, one of the icons of the civil rights movement, and then sort of passing on this bit of knowledge, I guess you would say, to Stokely Carmichael, who later became famous for being involved with the Black Panthers.
Yeah. And it wasn't just Fannie Lou Hamer. So you see other instances, Constance Baker Motley, for example, Judge Motley, when she was in Birmingham with Thurgood Marshall pressing desegregation cases. They stayed at the home of one of the local activists, and Judge Motley talks about how they were guarded by black men with guns, some on the roof, some secreted around the house, and that they were given an armed escort every day to court when they went to do the sort of formal work of the freedom struggle.
Yeah. There's a question you ask in your book, where is our Leonidas? The reference, of course, is to the Greek warrior who died while defending Sparta against the overwhelming force of the Persian army. So I'm wondering sort of how you see that in the context of this history that we've been talking about. I mean, sort of, is this a classic battle of a champion who meets force with force,
right,
even in the face of overwhelming odds?
Right. One of my impulses for writing the book was to try and address a sort of question that I had gotten at various points, sometimes from young black men and women who look back at the history of the civil rights movement and wonder sort of plaintively, well, didn't anybody fight back? And one response to that is, well, fighting back was not plausible because look at the overwhelming odds. But if you look at other cultures, and this was the Leonidas reference, fighting back even against long odds and even losing is the foundational clay of building up heroes. And one of the things I wanted to do in this book was to revive and reclaim those heroes that I always knew were out there. So where is our Leonidas? My goodness. I mean, I think it's an important aspect of trying to put into context these stories where oftentimes blacks used guns in self-defense in an effort that failed. That is, you find some shootout with the Klan where the Klan prevails. Well, the question is, were those people simply victims, or can we think about them in a more textured context? Should they be on someone's list of heroes? And what I argue or try to present in the book is that thinking about those people simply as victims is a disservice to their fight, is a disservice to their struggle. And we, like other cultures, that is black culture in the U.S., like other cultures, we long for, ultimately, these sorts of heroes. And they are, in fact, out there, and they're just loads. There are tons of them.
So, Professor Johnson, I have a personal question. Do you own a gun?
Yes, I do. I grew up in West Virginia. My parents got me my first gun when I was 14 years old. I did not know anyone who didn't have a firearm. My uncle was the president of the Greenbrier County NAACP from 1954 to 1977. And I was probably 10 years old when he told me the story of using a gun to fight off a racist attack. I saw and sort of experienced very early on the idea that there was not a real disconnect between the notion of the nonviolent civil rights movement and private self-defense.
And so for you, I mean, do you have the gun because this is sort of part of your personal history, part of the cultural history you've been talking about? Or do you have that partly for self-defense?
When I first started in academia, someone asked me the same question. And at the time, I was teaching at a little college in central Pennsylvania. And my response then was, I'm a black man married to a white woman living in the United States of America. Of course, I have a gun. So maybe that's the best response to the self-defense question.
Nicholas Johnson is a law professor. He teaches at Fordham Law School, and he's the author of Negroes and the Gun, The Black Tradition of Arms. Steve Paulson talked with him. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Only encounters with guns have happened in the pages of crime fiction, mostly in stories featuring women as detectives. I love all those tough, smart, independent women like Kinsey Malone, V.I. Warshawski, Miss Marple, Nancy Drew. But, you know, I can name dozens of those fictional female crime fighters, but not one single real-life woman detective or law enforcement officer. At least until I picked up historian Erica Janik's new book, Pistols and Petticoats. It's the story of how women moved from crime solving in fiction into the real world. So, Erica, I want to begin in 1856. That's when the biggest detective agency in the country, Pinkerton's, did something unprecedented. They hired a woman.
That's right. So her name was Kate Warne. We don't actually know all that much about her. She's the first known female detective. That doesn't mean that there weren't female detectives before her. But she actually came to Alan Pinkerton's office. He was based in Chicago, and she said she was a widower and that she needed a job. Pinkerton thought she was asking to be a secretary, but she was like, no, I want to be a detective. And she did all kinds of things. She helped to bust some railroad embezzlement. That was kind of her big case. She would dress in disguise and get close to the wives of suspects to learn clues that would help them solve the case. During the Civil War, she got some intel on Confederate movements by befriending and dressing up as a Southern belle. They were really worried that Abraham Lincoln was going to be assassinated on his way to take office in D.C., and so she helped disguise him from Baltimore.
This got left out of my American history. Wait,
there was all of these. There are all these fears because, you know, tensions over the Civil War were really high, and so there were a lot of fears when Abraham Lincoln was elected president that he would be assassinated before he could even get to D.C. And so Pinkerton had been hired, his firm, to help protect Abraham Lincoln, and so Kate Warne developed a plan to help shepherd him into D.C. safely. They went on this overnight train trip where Lincoln was disguised as her invalid brother. And she, you know, if any questions were asked, she just, from what it sounds like, basically said, like, oh, no, he can't answer. Oh, no, he's sick. And managed to get him safely to D.C.
Wow. First woman detective saves the life of Abraham Lincoln. It doesn't get much better than that. So what about some of the other early real-life detectives? There's one you write about who was, I guess, one of the first women hired as a detective on the Chicago police force, Alice Clement.
Absolutely. She was this kind of fireball of a woman who, for some reason, decided to join the police force when Chicago decided to hire 10 women to their force.
This is when?
This is 1912 is when she first joins. Women had been lobbying to get into law enforcement for decades leading up to this, and there was a lot of pressure on the Chicago mayor to hire women. And so he finally did, and they decided to hire 10 at once. And they had 2 hours of training, which basically consisted of the police chief telling them what not to do. And so, you know, they're just sent out on the street, often in pairs, and the media was basically just waiting with bated breath for something to happen.
So they were sent out to do what?
Mostly to protect other women. They were worried about women being sold into prostitution, being preyed on by men on the streets. A lot of what they did was just kind of going out and shepherding girls home at night if they were alone on the streets.
So this is like mothers with badges.
Yes. I mean, some of them even referred to themselves as kind of police mothers, and they talked about mothering on the streets. And many of them were mothers. Alice Clement was, in fact, a mother. And so she would often wear these very elaborate kind of silk gowns while she was out patrolling. And she also had a turban. And she always made this big kind of scene when she would make an arrest. And so she made for a very colorful copy. That was...
Well, and as you said, she got a ton of publicity. There's one case of hers that got written up a lot. It sounds to me like it's come straight out of Agatha Christie. This was the case called the Dulcimer.
Yes, that's right. There was a girl who had died. And so Alice Clement and her male partner went to investigate this. And they're looking around and the male officer is like, this is an open and shut case. Like, she clearly died from some disease. Maybe she had tuberculosis, maybe something else, cholera. There's no crime here. Alice looked around, though, and was like, I'm not so sure about that. This girl had played the dulcimer, and Alice picked it up, and she touches one of the strings, and there's some residue left on her finger. And so she asks for this dulcimer to be investigated. Long story short, she comes to find out that there had been some poison placed on the dulcimer strings by this girl's aunt, and the girl in playing the dulcimer had licked her fingers, as you often did when you're playing the instrument, to turn the pages of the music, and she had ingested this poison. But yes, it doesn't sound wow. like it could actually happen at all. It does sound like something straight out of a book.
Well, which is part of the point of your book, that the rise of women as detectives in real life in some ways paralleled the rise of women as detectives in fiction.
You do find them kind of appearing at the same time. I mean, the detective and the detective story is really a product of the 19th century. As police forces are kind of being put in place in urban places, the detective is this new figure. And so these stories start to appear in the mid-19th century, and women are both writing them as well as appearing as detectives in some of these stories. One of the things you find, though, is that the only women who are allowed to detect are young women and older unmarried women, the spinsters. Hmm. The elderly woman who's kind of a snoop and a gossip anyway, but she also seems like this really innocuous figure. I mean, no one suspects an elderly woman who's like working in her garden of being a detective.
Or Miss Marple knitting away endless baby garments.
Knitting is a big part of a lot of those spinsters. The needles are clacking as they're just like collecting clues and hearing all of these stories and putting pieces together.
Now, we haven't mentioned the girl detective, so I don't know about you, but I grew up on Nancy Drew. But I was surprised reading your book to discover Nancy Drew was just one. There were a whole lot of others. The one I love most, you have to describe her, Torchy Blaine.
So Torchy Blaine was actually a movie detective, and she, part of what she was famous for is that she talked a mile a minute. And the actress who played her, Glenda Farrell, it was said that she could say 400 words in a minute. I don't think that's possible.
Wait, 400 words in a minute?
Yes. So that's how fast talking she was. She was also kind of high flying in a way that real detectives weren't, because, you know, she had a gun and she solved some of murder cases and much more high profile things than a real female detective did.
Were there a lot of daring physical exploits?
She was very good at I think in one of her cases, she somehow jumps on the top of a train, like somersaults on top of the train, and then she just pulls her jacket down and keeps going. Unflappable, this woman.
Take that, James Bond.
That's right.
Could you make the argument that women's advances in fictional detecting always precede women's advances in the real world on police forces or crime prevention?
It does seem to be that way. It does seem like there's some kind of weird thing that I'm not sure I completely understand of how we're – it's just more acceptable for us to see women in these roles as long as it's fiction. But somehow when it's reality, it's much harder.
But do you think the fiction opens the door?
I think it does. I think it helps sometimes if we have this image of what it would actually look like for a woman to do that job. People probably growing up today that are going to move into the police force, if you grew up watching police shows and all of these detective shows, you would think that there's a woman on every single force, a woman working in every CSI kind of lab, and that's just not the case.
And what's the percentage?
15% of homicide detectives are women. 13% of police officers are women.
What about women police chiefs?
Those numbers have definitely gone up, but they're still a very, very small percentage of the force. I think it's interesting that there have been studies in recent years about women's use of force. Women are less likely to use force, female officers, that is. And so some of those studies have led some cities to hire more women as police chiefs, particularly as we all know that police brutality and quick resort to guns and violence has been in the headlines. So I think a lot of these studies that are talking about women using other methods may see an increase in the number of women that are actually hired into these positions.
Do you have a favorite woman detective, either in fiction or on screen today?
I would say my favorite is actually a TV character. She's a sheriff on the show Happy Valley, whose name is a complete misnomer. It is not happy there at all. but Susanna Kaywood, I just think she is an incredible woman. Every time I watch that show, I think I've never seen a woman on television like this before. She is extremely strong. She's very capable. She's had this horrible life. And I think she's both allowed to be vulnerable and strong. And she's just really smart and funny. That show shows a version of a woman in charge of a police force that I've never seen before.
That's fantastic. Thanks.
Thank you.
Erica Janik is my friend and colleague. She's a historian and the author of several books. We were talking about her latest called Pistols and Petticoats. She's also a public radio producer and runs a project we started together called Wisconsin Life. Hey, thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed it and maybe heard something worth sharing. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour. He had help from Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Special thanks today to Joe Hartke. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. We'll be back next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.